Welcome to the inaugural episode of Inflation Nation. My name's Arjun.
I'm Jay.
And today we're going to be talking about a market-based approach to emissions regulation. This is something that I recently researched in class, and I thought it would be an interesting topic to start off this economics podcast with.
Yeah, and I'm really interested to learn about it.
What questions do you have? Let me explain this topic to you.
Yeah, so first of all, I guess, what is emissions trading?
Yeah, so emissions trading, it's better known as cap and trade. And it works under a framework in which a government or a regulatory agency basically sets a total cap on emissions. And this is great because as many people have followed, in Paris and Kyoto, there were important climate goals. And these climate goals set pretty concrete standards on emissions limits to limit global warming and climate change more broadly. Cap and trade works by setting a total cap on emissions every year. And then they divide this cap, regulatory agencies divide this cap into one-ton permits. And each of these one-ton permits are priced depending on the regulatory agency. These prices could be anywhere from zero if they decide to auction them off for free, all the way up to $100, for example.
So it's done by auction?
Yeah, exactly. So it's done by auction. Although there are some markets in which to improve efficiency or to benefit certain businesses that are struggling, a regulatory agency can give these permits out for free. But we can get into that a bit more later. Yeah.
Okay.
Once these permits are auctioned off and they're held by these businesses, these businesses can trade these permits. And that's the really cool and nuanced aspect of cap and trade. It's a very, very market-based approach to a topic that's usually addressed by command and control regulation, which comes in the form of regulations from the EPA that are very concrete. So cap and trade allows these businesses to essentially pay to pollute. On the other hand, it allows regulatory agencies to set a total cap on emissions. So it's kind of cool because it's a win-win.
Yeah. So are there any really good examples of when this has been used and to regulate emissions?
Yeah, totally. We can get into that. So the U.S. In the 1990s, there was a big issue in the U.S. Basically, we were experiencing acid rain. And this acid rain was a direct result of emissions of sulfur dioxide, and basically to limit these emissions and to eventually curb acid rain as a whole, the administration at that time, which was and during the 90s, it's also important to note that there was a growing movement to move towards more conservative economic policies.
Who was the president at the time?
I believe it was Clinton.
Clinton, right? Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it was Clinton when this first cap and trade was introduced. A growing conservative movement meant that businesses were demanding, and politicians alike were demanding, a more market based approach to emissions regulation.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It was originally implemented here, it was called the Clean Air Act of 1990, George Bush, Bush was president during that time, and it was extremely effective. It cost utility companies $3 billion as opposed to the $25 billion price of a command and control strategy, and it also succeeded in its goal of reducing sulfur dioxide emissions to 50% of 1980 levels by 2010. And it even achieved this goal ahead of schedule. It's important to acknowledge that this Clean Air Act of 1990 was relatively limited. Sulfur dioxide emissions were not nearly as large of a problem as carbon emissions as a whole are today. But nevertheless, it served as a really important example, a really important framework that that future cap and trade initiatives were really centered around. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, in Singapore, I know they have a cap on the number of cars or license plates they issue a year, so it's kind of something similar to that. I guess market-based allocations of licenses are really useful. You discussed earlier that there would be, sometimes they give them out for free to help companies when they're struggling? Like, what would be an example of that? What does that happen?
Yeah, totally. So, in every market, there's going to be businesses that are more competitive than others. And to improve competition, you know, you may have heard of antitrust regulation.
Yeah.
That's on the other end of the spectrum. That regulates monopolies. But when governments are engaging in regulating a market, such as energy production and related to carbon emissions, to improve competition, they can give out permits for free to certain businesses that are struggling to enter a market, or maybe have a more green alternative. For example, if a given business is engaging in a green transition, if a utility company is engaging in a green transition but still is emitting carbon, the regulatory agency could provide them permits for free to lower their cost and ease this transition towards green alternatives such as solar, hydroelectric, or any renewable energy source such as that. So yeah,
interesting. I mean, yeah. So why would this be better than a carbon tax? Just something to de-incentivize. Another example of de-incentivizing companies from emission.
Yeah, sure. So a carbon tax has been a more simple and tested way to reduce emissions. Just like any other tax, it basically imposes an added cost on polluting. The difficulty with a carbon tax is that it gives regulatory agencies less leeway. As I previously mentioned, cap and trade allows regulatory agencies to set a complete cap on emissions for a given year. A carbon tax imposes an added cost, a Pigouvian tax on emissions.
Pigouvian.
That's just generally the term for a tax on negative externality. Externality being emissions, yeah. Carbon emissions. Carbon tax, it imposes this added cost, but it doesn't give regulators a concrete idea of emissions for a given year. So, similarly to cap and trade, some of the benefits of a carbon tax is that it provides governments with revenue. And this is helpful because revenues, the way these laws are structured, often the added revenue from these programs is directed into further accelerating the green revolution. So with a carbon tax, similar to cap and trade, by engaging in this regulation, the government draws relatively large revenues and is able to use this to fund tax cuts, for example, for electric vehicle manufacturers or for companies that are at the forefront of the green transition, or to individual families if you're purchasing an electric car.
Just encourage it, yeah.
Exactly. It can also give governments the ability to provide added subsidies. And what makes these cap and trade, what makes cap and trade regulations so politically popular, is that they often end up being not requiring the government to go into a deficit with this with imposition of the program. It's a net zero cost, meaning that all of the added revenues that are gained from this program are spent on, as I previously mentioned, either tax cuts or subsidies. So it's a popular way to, it's a popular and politically easy way to solve the negative externality of carbon emissions.
You know what's interesting to me is that, like, why would a conservative government decide to put a hard limit on what the people can do? Like, how is that, does that fit in with the conservative mindset?
Yeah.
Like government control?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess from a political ideology standpoint, a conservative would ideally, I mean, a pure conservative.
Yeah, would limit government intervention.
Right. It would, a purely conservative view on this topic would be to not have any government intervention at all.
True.
To not regulate the market.
True.
A proponent of free markets, a popular example is Milton Friedman, would assert that the market would solve all of its externalities on its own. There was a famous economist, his name was Ronald Coase. He theorized that negative externalities, specifically what we're talking about, it's actually the issue of negative externalities can be worked out by free markets using negotiation and private settlements. And Friedman and Coase were in the University of Chicago School of Thought, and they they were really at the forefront of this antithesis to the idea that government regulation is necessary. So I kind of got off topic there. But yeah, a conservative would ideally prefer absolutely no government intervention. But the great thing with cap and trade is that it really provides an extremely high level, an astonishing level of flexibility for businesses.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I mean, you have a complete cap. But once that cap is set and once permits are auctioned, everything is up to the businesses. If they would like to pollute, if they would like to fulfill 10% of the permits for that a given year, if they're willing to pay the price for it, they can. And prices are, once permits are auctioned, prices are fully determined by market forces.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's the perfect, like, balance between government control and business regulation, because as much as businesses want, they can technically pollute, but government has a hard cap on that. It just increases the prices for pollution.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a great way to think about it is that it's pay to pollute, essentially.
Yeah.
And that added level of freedom is why it's been a popular way to solve the issue of carbon emissions. And unfortunately, though, in the U.S., it hasn't been completely popular. During the Obama administration, can't remember exactly which year. I believe it was 2014. There was a cap and trade law that was proposed, and it passed through the House. It's important to note that at this time, the Democrats controlled the House, the Senate, and the presidency. It passed through the House with a decent margin, and then it got to the Senate. And this is an interesting way to highlight the push and pull and the policy aspect of implementing cap and trade. Once it got to the Senate, it essentially needed 60 votes to pass because of the Senate filibuster rule. With the Senate filibuster rule, there's unlimited debate, and because there's such a tight docket of laws that are getting considered by the Senate, you basically need a 60 vote majority to stop this debate and bring the bill to a vote. So all that to say that even though Democrats had a sizable majority in the Senate, I believe it was over 54 seats in the Senate, they still lack this high 60 vote threshold. And all that to say that despite Democrats having such a strong control over the national government, this bill was not able to be passed. And it would have undoubtedly been signed by President Barack Obama. So there's policy challenges to this, despite it being a relatively common sense way to deal with carbon emissions. I guess from the policy standpoint, there's also some important things to highlight. I know, Jay, you asked me before this podcast about previous implementations of cap and trade, and how looking forward we could have better frameworks.
Yeah.
In the European Union, there was what's called the emissions trading system.
I was just gonna ask before you jump to this, so it's a perfect segue. I mean, like, with the obvious Paris agreements, the Kyoto agreements, what were the international implications? Have other countries utilized the cap and trade because it's been so effective in the U.S.? So yeah, please continue.
Yeah. So the ETS, for short, was really the first major cap and trade system imposed. Because the Clean Air Act of 1990 was relatively limited, and we can see that in the fact that government revenues only, the program only cost $3 billion, so it had a very small purview.
Mm.
The ETS was imposed in the European Union in the Eurozone, speaking economically, it followed the simple cap and trade framework. The EU set a total cap on emissions permits, and auctioned them off. In several years, it became the biggest emissions trading market in the world. For several years, the European Union was effective in reducing the total cap every year, and that's another important thing to point out. The the way that cap and trade achieves long-term emissions goals and emission standards is by lowering the total cap every year. And by doing this, they can slowly but surely phase out greenhouse gases and fossil fuel uses. And the European Union's ETS was effective in this for several years. I don't know if I mentioned, but it was implemented in 2003. But today it's little more than a relic of environmental regulation, and it serves as more of an example of how not to implement cap and trade. And there's a couple of important reasons why. So for cap and trade to be effective, there really needs to be a free market. The idea behind cap and trade is that market forces determine the price to pollute. The European Union hindered this free market because, while also implementing a cap and trade system, they imposed pretty heavy command and control regulations. It's kind of just a fancy term to describe more traditional carbon emissions regulations. No, not taxes. So an example of this would be the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, saying in these areas you cannot build a coal-fired power plant, or there's only a certain number of coal-fired power plants that you can build in a given year or in a given area, or saying for example, ethanol needs to make up this portion of gas that goes into cars that we can have biofuel. And the EU made a mistake by imposing this command and control regulation alongside cap and trade, because it essentially destroyed the free market structure. No matter how effective command and control regulation is, or how theoretically impartial it is, it will favor some parties over others. And by doing this, the government was essentially destroying the free market structure. Some firms were in a more advantageous position than others, and some firms incurred more costs due to this command and control. The EU fell prey to what many regulatory programs fall prey to, and that's lobbying. Large businesses that emit lots of carbon and are going to be paying a high price under cap and trade are naturally going to lobby. They're going to try to get their interests pushed forward in legislative bodies, and this happened in the EU, there were lots of many permits were given away for free as such, and they were given away preferentially, all of this meant that the price of a 1-ton permit under the ETS 10 years following the implementation of the ETS, so April 2013. The price of a 1-ton permit was below 3 euros, and to contextualize this number, the World Bank estimates that to achieve the Paris Accords in 2015, to achieve the goal set in Paris in 2015, the price of a 1-ton permit on the open market must be between $40 and $80, and we don't need to go into exchange rates, but generally, just assuming that the dollar and the euro are of similar value. There's a massive, massive discrepancy between 40 and 3, obviously.
I was going to ask, with such high regulations, does that create a more monopolistic market structure? With an increase in barriers to entry, are those barriers to entry high but not high enough to completely just cause firms to leave markets?
Yeah, no, that's an important question. Sometimes by raising the cost to pollute, you essentially make markets a monopoly, because the only markets that can survive are the ones that are already the most efficient, yeah, or already have the largest economies of scale. But with the goal of cap and trade is to do one of two things. It's either to phase out carbon emissions and fossil fuel use by essentially driving the price of polluting so high that it's just physically cheaper to use green alternatives than to use fossil fuels. And the way this works is that by reducing the total cap on emissions every year, the regulatory agencies create scarcity. This is just a basic economic principle. When there's scarcity, There's supply and demand. And eventually the scarcity increases to such an extent that the price of polluting is higher than the price of transitioning to green energy. Firms that are profit maximizing will transition to green energy. Yeah. The second outcome that's equally effective, arguably, is that firms still pollute. Firms still pollute under this program. They pay the price though, and essentially this is all right as long as the total cap is set to a limit that ensures that long term emissions aren't going to raise global temperatures that much. And a level of carbon emissions is all right as long as it's closely monitored by environmental agencies. It's all right if firms are emitting a certain level of carbon, because we can still reach our long-term goals, that the aforementioned long-term goals set in Paris and Kyoto. So yeah.
Hope yeah. Thank you.
Question. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess cap and trade is really a great way to combine government intervention and market forces. I mean, yeah, it sounds like a great initiative that, I mean, obviously is very effective. I think more countries should implement this, and the U.S. should continue to use cap and trade. Thank you for talking and educating me about this.
Yeah, for sure. But before we end, I want to highlight one thing that I neglected to mention in my own research, but I think that is important to consider really in the greater concept of international relations and policy relating to these looming threats such as climate change. The U.S. could implement a national cap and trade system. And arguably, they should. The issue with this, though, is that if other large carbon-emitting countries, such as China or India or members of the EU or emerging economies that are going to be on the leaderboard of, you know, top ten GDP countries, a lot of these are in Africa, such as Nigeria or Ethiopia, countries with large developing economies with large increases in population every year. If these countries don't follow suit and essentially adhere to the same standards that the U.S. is imposing on itself, the U.S. is, from purely economic stance, doing itself a disservice, because U.S. firms are going to lose comparative advantage over international firms that don't incur these costs when they pollute and can produce at a lower price. So there's a cost to there's a cost to the entire U.S. For being essentially standing on the moral high ground and implementing cap and trade. So I think this is a bit of a pipe dream, because it's unlikely that international relations are going to be this smooth. But in an ideal world, there would be a UN resolution that would mandate cap and trade for most major economies, so that all of these large carbon emitting countries could cooperate and lower carbon emissions as a unit, instead of cutting each other down by reducing one another's comparative advantage and essentially disadvantaging the countries that decide to pursue common sense climate change regulation.
Yeah.
So yeah,
there is a tipping point between the economy and society. I mean, we do need a future.
Exactly.
Yeah, thank you for educating me a lot. Arjun's document, his research, will be linked down below underneath the podcast, so feel free to check it out.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you guys so much for listening. We'll see you next time.
Bye.